This hour, the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by Northwest Safe. There is a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending at home?
So Jay Inslee is being sued for what seems like a clear instance of overstepping his constitutional authority. It's so clear that even the Democrats are involved in this. This is the state legislature with Republican support and Democrat support suing Jay Inslee. So in other words, it's a bipartisan effort. In other words, this is something that's incredibly, incredibly important and meaningful for us to be paying attention to. Let's make sure my computer is up there. Here's Senator Mark Schessler. Are we not getting audio up there? Computer number one, PC number one. Okay, we'll figure out the audio in a second. This is important because what they're doing here right now is talking specifically about the ability to take out veto individual sentences. Because that is what he is trying to do, Jay Inslee, in this particular budget. That he thinks it's appropriate, that it is legal to cut out individual sentences from, in this case, a transportation budget. Now, the law is pretty clear. The law, in fact, is incredibly clear when it comes to what can and cannot be vetoed. What cannot be vetoed are individual words, individual sentences. What can be vetoed, according to the law, and this was decided back in the 70s, and it was a constitutional amendment that was pushed forward, basically said, hey, if you're going to make a veto, you can only veto individual sections, right? You can veto the entire piece of legislation. When it comes to budgets, you can veto independent sections, but not individual sentences. And the reason behind it is very clear. The reason behind it is because right now you've got, in this case, a whole bunch of people who are working on a transportation budget that, generally speaking, is a bipartisan effort. When we're talking about these types of budgets, you need bipartisan support. So Republicans have certain things that are very important to them. Democrats have certain things that are very important to them. And they get together and they say, okay, we'll give you this if you give us that. And then they go ahead and they put it into a budget and everybody is happy. What's different, however, is when you decide to allow a governor, regardless of whether or not he's a Republican or a Democrat, the simple ability to just take out individual sentences. When you take out individual sentences, what you can do then, if you're a Democrat, in this case, Jay Inslee, could say, okay, you know what? I know that this was a bipartisan transportation budget. I'm just going to cut out this one sentence here. It just so happens to be what the Democrats agreed to allow Republicans to push so that they would push something for them. So we're just going to take it out. And then, of course, it becomes veto-proof. And so everybody realized that this is an alarming amount of power that we would give up to the governor, again, regardless of whether or not there's an R or a D next to their name. And so it all goes about this way. Jay Inslee has decided to push so dangerously towards one side of having too much power that even the Democrats have stepped up. When in this environment, this atmosphere politically, when you've got Republicans and Democrats on the same side, generally, not always, generally, that means, that they're probably on the right side of this. Now, for his part, Jay Inslee is saying, oh, well, actually, the courts haven't been specific on this one particular issue. And so he goes, you know, this is all good faith. You know, we can't wait for the courts to decide. The courts are very clearly going to decide that a line item veto like this, a sentence veto like this, is not appropriate. And I don't think that any court's going to get in the way of that. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending on the campaign trail?
So identity politics essentially means that folks will judge you based on your gender, on your race, on your religion, on your sexual orientation, but not necessarily on your political philosophy or political values or, you know, your political principles. And instead, they decide to focus on things that you were born as. They don't really care about all the other stuff. And so Joe Biden is in the thick of things, I suppose, a little bit in this case, where he is weighing in on whether or not he's going to pick someone as a vice presidential running mate if he becomes the president. Is he going to pick someone who is female? Is he going to pick someone who is from a community of color? Or is it just going to be another white dude? Now, the Washington Post asked him recently, as he was speaking to a group of black journalists, say, hey, you know, who would you like to see as the vice presidential pick if you get the nomination? And he said, quote, whomever I pick, preferably it will be someone who has color, who was of color and or different gender, but I'm not making that commitment until I know that the person I'm dealing with, I can completely and thoroughly trust as authentic and on the same page as me. Now, it's a argument. It's a line that he's done this before. He's made this line before with Chris Cuomo back in July on CNN that says, hey, you know, I would prefer someone who is a representative of a community of color. I would prefer that they be female. But, you know, I'm not going to commit to anything yet because I want to make sure that they are simpatico, was the word that he used, with me on principle. And I suppose that's as fair as a statement you're going to get from a Democrat who is pushing into this identity politics. There are people who believe on the Democratic side, and this is a loud and growing voice. I don't think it's the main voice. I don't think it's all Democrats, but it's a significant wing of the Democratic Party that says because he happens to be a white dude, a white cisgender dude, does not mean that should mean that he's not going to pick someone as a VP who also shares that similar characteristic, meaning you can't have another white candidate with you. That's inherently against what the Democrats stand for, because we are the Democratic Party. We stand for people who are not just old cisgendered white dudes who happen to be Catholic. That's what they believe. It's a bizarre belief system for me, right? It seems inherently condescending. I think when you come out there and say, well, of course, I would love to have someone who is a person of color or a woman on my side as the VP. Number one, it sounds like you're saying they're not good enough to be president because you've got that taken care of. It's all good. You're in charge. Number two, it just seems like pandering. And I keep putting myself in a position where if someone on the right, a candidate that maybe I liked who was running for president, would say, well, you know what? I'm a white dude. I'm a white Republican. But don't you guys worry. I'm going to get a Jewish vice president because you know what? It's really important for me to show my support to Jews. You can support Jews the same way you can support Latinos or Asians or transgenders or atheists without actually getting someone who identifies with any of those characteristics. You can actually propose policies that make sense. You can propose ideas and principles and prescriptions that specifically impact positively a group of people that you're trying to pander to without just simply saying, oh, well, I'm going to get, if I don't get someone who's a black running mate or female running mate or Jewish running mate or a gay running mate, it means I really am not going to be able to address those concerns. I don't believe that. But that's kind of the subtext in all of this, isn't it? You're going to pick someone who is African-American and female because only then can he truly placate African-American female voters, I suppose, which is also weird because I don't vote based on a characteristic. You have a Jewish candidate in front of me. I'm not going to say, oh, well, I'm in because you're Jewish. Well, no, I'm going to look at what you stand for. Do you have policies that I agree with? Are you principled in a way that I support? Are you pushing certain policies that I can say, okay, it's going to make my life better, not just as a Jewish person or as a gay person, but simply as an American who happens to live, in this case, in Seattle? Are you going to make my life better? Are you going to put justices on the Supreme Court or in federal judge positions that actually, you know, support a constitutional rule of law, a constitutionally principled view on the law? If the answer to that is no, but you happen to be Jewish or gay or whatever, I'm like, okay, I don't support you. Identity politics is just a weird place to be, not just because of the subtext, but because if you're choosing to judge someone solely based on that characteristic, I feel like you're setting yourself up for failure. I feel like you're setting yourself up for failure at the end of the day. Because they're not going to vote the way you think they're going to vote. They're not going to side on policies the way you think, because you simply judge them by what they look like or what religion they happen to believe in. And that, I think, is a dangerous place to be. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. Let's get you home the right way with the Right Way Traffic.
In Seattle, an earlier accident southbound 99 approaching Mercer Street has cleared the roadway. Traffic still backed up as you head across the Aurora Bridge towards the scene. Southbound I-5 in comparison backed up from Northgate coming into downtown Seattle. And we are seeing sluggish congestion from Seattle as you make your way towards Everett. That's going to be an hour and 15 minutes. Summer not going your way? Ford gets it. This Labor Day, say sayonara to summer madness with this year's best deal on a new Ford truck. Hurry to buyfordnow.com or head to your local Ford dealer and take a test drive today. You're listening to AM 770 KTTH.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/JasonRantsShow. Go there now, hit the follow button, go behind the scenes of the show. We just posted our video introduction of producer Peyton, who's brand new to the crew, doing a terrific job. And if you want to see it, facebook.com/JasonRants. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at the movies?
Hey, it's Friday. You know what that means? It means I get to talk movies thanks to our sponsor, Alpine Specialty Cleaning at alpineclean.com. The big weekend release is Don't Let Go. It's a time travel cop procedural. It stars David Oyelowo as a detective in Los Angeles trying to solve the murder of his niece, Ashley. But the case changes rather significantly when his niece calls him after she's already been brutally killed.
Who is this?
Who do you think it is?
Where are you calling from?
I'm at my house. In my bedroom.
What's the date today?
It's June 25th.
Believe it or not, I'm sitting right here. 2 weeks in the future.
I don't understand.
There's a crime that in your time hasn't yet happened. Your dad's gonna die. Your mom's gonna die. And so are you. But as long as you're alive, you can change things.
Okay, so the premise of the movie, I think, is really, really interesting and unique. And I think they managed to pull it off pretty effectively. And a lot of that has to do with the two leads, Oyelowo and Storm Reid. Their relationship, their chemistry drives this movie. They work the concept, I think, as best as they can. But the film ends up breaking down in the last 30 minutes or so. The concept, I think, ultimately ends up getting undercut and underserved by a third act that I think is just really bad. It becomes way too predictable and way too unbelievable. And I say unbelievable in a movie about time travel. I weirdly found all the other stuff to work really, really well, except the third act. The movie tries to be a little bit scary. And, you know, you get this sort of dipping of the toes into the horror genre. You heard the music they play in the trailer. It mostly works in that regard, but I think it's more like a psychological thriller than anything else. This is a very well-done movie, beautifully shot. And again, the acting is pretty outstanding. But the storyline problems it ends up encountering towards the end of the movie is just really, really maddening, because it ends up souring what I think is a pretty decent murder mystery. It's better than it is bad, and it's coming out at a time when summer movie rollouts tend to start to sputter. But ultimately, I'm not recommending it. Don't Let Go is out now. Its R rating, I think, is unjustified to me. There is some brutal violence, but I don't think it's particularly brutal. I don't think it's particularly over the top. I didn't think it deserved the R rating, but that's what it's got. I don't necessarily recommend this movie. I think more than not, this is a movie that you're going to enjoy when you rent it rather than see it in theaters. What movie are you going to see this weekend? Send me a text on the None Better Tax Resolution hotline. 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
So in June 2019, SDOT, the Seattle Department of Transportation, they decided to reduce the fleet for both Lime rideshare bikes and Uber Jump rideshare bikes. They decided to reduce that fleet maximum by about 1,000. Why? Because both of the companies apparently misreported the bike parking situation for them, the ones that were improperly parked out on sidewalks in a place where they're not supposed to actually be put out. So the problem hasn't been fixed, apparently. And as a result, I don't think it ever will be. I'm not entirely sure I understand exactly where it is they want to go with this. So the companies Lime and Uber Jump, they agreed to a set of goals, none of which seem attainable, but they agreed to the goals. Number one, they said 0% of audited bikes blocking a clear pedestrian pathway. They'll try to get to 0%. of bikes blocking a clear pedestrian pathway. Then they said they would try to get to no more than 3% of audited bikes presenting obstruction hazards to pedestrians or anyone that's living with a disability. And then they said they would try to get no more than 30% of audited bikes parked incorrectly in any way, shape, or form. Now, they didn't hit the benchmarks. They didn't hit the benchmarks because they have very little control over how people are parking these bikes. So SDOT did their audit. They found 1.6% of bikes blocking pedestrian pathways, 17.4% presenting obstruction hazards, 32.5% parked incorrectly. And so as a consequence, SDOT came back and they said, okay, we're reducing your fleets again. So they reduced it by another 1,000 bikes apiece. Now, any city in a scenario like this would probably step up and try to offer some additional bits of assistance, I suppose, in making it so that these companies can thrive. Because we all want these companies to thrive. I am annoyed slightly with the clutter on some of the sidewalks. There's no doubt about it. Some of the clutter, there's just way too much stuff out there. However, I've gotten used to it. And when you think about the fact that these bikes essentially are helping the local economy, helping get cars off the roads, helping get some folks off of buses that are already overcrowded, responsible for some jobs here in the area, we should all stand up and say, you know what, I want this to work, whether we're talking about Seattle or Redmond or Tacoma. Bike share is a good idea. And so the city is coming up and they're like, okay, we're going to try to help, I guess. We're going to build about 1,500 parking spaces for bikes all across the city. They say they're going to take advantage of space that isn't currently being used. I don't know if that's going to actually help, because a big part of the bike share business model is to be able to just kind of drop off your bikes wherever it is you can and then just go about your day. They say they're adding 160 new parking spaces for bikes along Alki Beach and Seacrest Marina, including a new corral that's going to be the largest in Seattle. Again, I suppose that helps a little bit, but that's not going to change any of this. This puts, at the end of the day, I think, an unfair burden on the rideshare companies. I know people who get very upset. Some of them are in this building. They get very upset at just the sight of these rideshare bikes. They will knock them down. There's clearly a homeless community that has used some of these bikes, knocked them down. There are people who have created these like graveyards of sorts of these bike shares, just putting them in large piles in random spots. That is not Uber Pool's fault. That is not Lime Bike's fault. That's the fault of the individual, right? This whole idea, I was trying to think of ways that they can do this. So if you're driving one of the Lime cars, before you're able to exit the app, you have to take a photo of the car and show that you had parked it correctly. And then I said, okay, is that something that we can then do in regards to the bikes? And the answer is no, because let's say I parked the bike correctly, I take the photo, I upload it to the app, and then someone who doesn't like bikes ends up moving them or knocking them over or somehow getting them in the middle of a sidewalk. Well, do I get pinged for that? Is that my fault? And frankly, is it Uber Pool's fault? Is it Lime Bike's fault? I would say no. And I do think that they're overstating the problem here a little bit. I mean, it's probably more dramatic than a little bit. Are we really like interacting with bikes that much that they're in the middle of sidewalks? And let's say they are, you can't move them. Every once in a while when I'm walking down the street and there happens to be a Lime Bike in the middle of a sidewalk where it shouldn't be, and I've encountered that before, you know what I do? How's this for weird? I move it. I literally just move it to the side, or I walk around it. Now, yes, it is certainly plausible that someone's in a wheelchair or someone who is living with a disability is not able to do that. That's incredibly rare still. It's bad when it happens. We want to be able to mitigate as best as we possibly can. But let's stop pretending that it's such a huge problem. Such a huge problem that the city really needs to get involved here in a bigger way than they already are. Because every single bike that they take off the street is another bike that is not being used, which means someone else is in a car, someone else is on an already crowded bus, tax dollars not being collected, jobs on the line. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to join the conversation on the Numb Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. You're listening to The Jason Rance Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. You are live in the Online Trading Academy studio. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really do appreciate it. I hope everyone has some fun plans for the weekend. Maybe you're going to Bumbershoot. No one goes to Bumbershoot anymore. Maybe you're just going to stay at home, maybe catch up on the week's worth of political news. There was an interview that was on Fox Business today. Stuart Varney was the host, and he had Joe Walsh on. Joe Walsh, who has absolutely no shot in the world at becoming president. There is no universe in which Joe Walsh becomes president. Though he's claiming now, I might run as a third party candidate. I'm going to screw stuff up for the president. It's not going to happen. It's going to get him absolutely nowhere. But media outlets keep putting him on TV. And they do it for their own purposes. You have folks on CNN and MSNBC having him on simply because he's anti-Trump, and it gives them another opportunity to have a former Tea Party Republican bash the president. Then you've got, in this case, Fox Business with Stuart Varney. There's no real reason to have Joe Walsh on unless you're trying to get the attention of the president. Unless you're all like, hey, Trump likes Jeanine Pirro. Trump likes Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham. Trump doesn't know I exist. So I'm going to defend the president, in some cases, in a very disingenuous way. And I think regardless of whether or not you're a Trump supporter, you can at least listen to some of the interview and say, okay, there's something a little shady going on here. All Stuart Varney is trying to do in this interview with Joe Walsh is impress the president.
This president, Stuart, as I said, is an unfit con man. I think he's unfit to be president. I think he's a real danger to this country. I think he's a child, Stuart. And I think America is strong enough that handle his four-year tantrum, but
you
not
have no
another
credibility,
4 years
Joe,
of this president.
You have no credibility for saying something like that, bearing you in mind all of the things that you've said in the past. Now, maybe you can say you don't need credibility, but you're just going right there insulting our president on top of a whole series of insults. I have to believe you just want the publicity. That's okay. It, isn't it?
So the truth is, yes, Joe Walsh just wants the publicity, right? The reason why he's running for president and the reason why he all of a sudden has decided to come out as this anti-Trump voice is because he needed to save his failing radio career. His radio show had been moved from primetime into overnights. It was about to be dumped. So he decides, you know what? I see Anthony Scaramucci and all these other people who used to be really hardcore Trump supporters end up going on and saying that he's the worst. And then all of a sudden, they've got book deals coming out. They're going to be on MSNBC and CNN all the time. I'll do exactly the same thing. And so that's what they're doing. Now, at the same time, you've got Stuart Varney, who's being just as disingenuous here as Joe Walsh. This whole idea that Trump has never lied ever in the history of it, that is not a good faith talking point. Every politician in the history of politics has lied. Now, I think a more honest talking point, one that I'd like to have a conversation about, is the way that certain members of the media talk about claims coming from the president, such as him not lying but saying something they happen to disagree with, but instead of saying they disagree with the point, the analysis, they say, oh, well, he's lying here. No, that's a dishonest way to talk about all of this. If I say today is Thursday, and then he was like, oh, actually, it's Friday. You're a liar. Well, no, I didn't lie. I just thought today was Thursday. We decide, because folks in the media don't like Trump, they've decided that they're just going to call out everything as a lie, as a knowing lie. Not as a mistake, which I have to assume he makes a lot of, based on some of the comments that he's made. And then, yes, sometimes it is a lie, but you have to be able to differentiate. Here's the difference. So there's this President Trump lies website up by the Natural Resource Defense Council, the NRDC. And this is what they say is a lie. They call out a very specific quote from the president. He was talking about a clean water rule that's on the books. He said, quote, if you want to build a new home, for example, you have to worry about getting hit with a huge fine if you fill in as much as a puddle, just as a puddle on your lot. Now, a normal person would listen to that and say, okay, that's clear hyperbole. He's trying to make a point. He's exaggerating to talk about how overzealous this particular rule is. But if you're the NRDC, you go out and say, oh, he's lying because the clean water rule doesn't actually regulate puddles. That's not what he meant. And you guys know it. But Joe Walsh will come out and say, well, actually, he always lies. He can't help himself but to lie.
You asked me a question. I'm running against this president because I believe he lies virtually every time he opens his mouth. You know that, too.
No, I do not.
I believe he's morally unfit.
I do not know that.
And I believe,
do not impute that to me, Joe Walsh.
I like this phony indignation. Don't you dare impugn my integrity.
Don't do it.
Country.
Don't do it. Do not impute that on me. I invited you on. You're on this program because I got questions. Oh my God, we've just gone to black. Okay.
His screen just temporarily went out.
Look, you're on the program because I've got questions that I want to ask. And when I get an answer like, I know, Stuart Varney knows that the president lies, I'm going to push back. Because that's nonsense, and you know it's nonsense, and don't try to bring me
Stuart
into your phony arguments.
Okay. He's tough, man. Stuart Varney, you don't want to get into a fight with him, because he's tough. And you know what the Brits are known for? Their toughness.
Are they?
Yeah, they win wars all the time. They're all down with that.
That's news to me.
I know, it's news to everyone. I don't like Stuart Varney, and I want to tweet it out, but because I go on Fox News a lot, I feel like that might get me on the radar in a negative way, and so I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to do it on the radio.
Yeah, just tell a bunch of people through, the Pacific Northwest. Don't tell your Twitter followers.
Yeah. Well, because they're not listening in New York to this show or D.C. They don't listen. They just follow me on Twitter. Then Joe Walsh goes on to make a point that Trump is a bigot. Although, in this case, I do think Varney pushes back in an effective way. Although, again, it's a little bit hypocritical.
I apologize for helping to create the environment that put such a cruel, bigoted, unfit con man in the White House. I feel sort of responsible for this. I do. We've got somebody in the White House.
So, by the way, I'm responsible. Reward me by making me president.
Stuart, who believes he's above the law. We've got somebody in the White House who puts his own interest ahead of the country's interest at every single turn. That should concern all of us.
You say that the president is bigoted. You, sir, are bigoted. Listen to this. June 2016, you said, no more Muslims in the U.S. They want us dead. They seek to kill us. Islam is a doctrine of hatred, etc., etc., etc. That's bigotry, any way you slice it.
It is bigotry. At the same time, I think you have to be very careful in all of this, because Joe Walsh was one of the birthers, and that's something that I do think was inherently bigoted. But President Trump, at the time, Donald Trump, businessman, was also pushing that forward. Now, the difference, I suppose, is I legitimately think Joe Walsh did it because he's a bigot. In the case of Trump, I think he was playing towards bigotry. I think he'll play towards anything if it means it's going to get him some press, if it means it's going to get him some followers, even from some people, some elements of society that we all reject. So, for Varney to push that out there, I mean, okay, but you also just defended Trump just tooth and nail. I mean, you were ready to fight. And I think it's important that we got to be very careful. If you're going to do that and you're going to go after Joe Walsh, go after Joe Walsh. I'd love to go after Joe Walsh. The difference is I've never actually pushed the birtherism nonsense. So I can at least go after Joe Walsh from a better position, of a slightly more pure position, of, just general honesty and good faith arguments. Joe Walsh is a scam artist. I'm glad people are calling him out. And to be fair to CNN and MSNBC, I do think that they also call him out. But you're going to see more and more and more of Joe Walsh show up on these TV shows because he's going to call out the president. And then CNN can go out there and say, well, guess what? We have a Republican on. You say we never have any Republicans on. Joe Walsh is on. They only like certain types of Republicans, and they definitely don't like the strong Trump supporters. They love the Trump haters. And that's why you see these folks on all the time. Jennifer Rubin, who's a Washington Post columnist, who's supposedly the conservative blogger there. She has never taken a conservative stance on anything. Anything. I defy anybody to find a conservative column by Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Literally anything, including simply saying, I'm a Republican. You tell me where that is. This is a scam, and they do it all the time, and people fall for it, and that drives me nuts. 1-800-465-877. We got a text at the 253 that says, is it bigotry if it's true? It's not true, and that's why it's bigotry. It is not true. That's exactly why we call it bigoted. 1-800-465-877. Promo code KTTH. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to join the conversation. I'm someone who generally doesn't like to see other people happy. And when everyone gets super excited about pumpkin spice lattes, it kind of, I'm not going to lie, it just bothers me. I do like the pumpkin spice lattes. They taste very good at Starbucks. I'm just saying, everyone getting super excited annoys me.
Really?
Yeah, why should everybody else be happy and me be miserable every single day? Granted, it's selfish.
Find your own happiness, then.
I'm never going to be happy. I'm content with that. And so when I get upset at people going after the happy people beyond the way I already go after them, then I feel like we've sort of peaked at what's acceptable in society. And this post at the Washington Post online on their blog is such a garbage heap. It's just like it has to be ridiculed. It's an article that's written by Jillian Brockle. This is the title of this story. Pumpkin Spice Wars. The violent history behind your favorite Starbucks latte. PSL is back, and so is its connection to a centuries-old genocide. Okay, really, guys? I mean, really? And the whole point of this article, and by the way, if you thought, oh, well, maybe she's trying to do some fun history and teach you things, it's not even a long story. It's like four paragraphs long. It doesn't get into anything. She's trying to go after the different ingredients and shows the history behind it. And she focuses on nutmeg because I guess nutmeg in the Middle Ages, people went to war over it. It's like, okay, that's your whole story. Like, you're using that to try to shame people into thinking that them enjoying a pumpkin spice latte is somehow showing a weird connection, yet again, to genocide? No. I mean, here's the deal. Every single ingredient that you enjoy, every single ingredient you don't enjoy, unless it's been engineered recently in, like, modern history, is going to be tied to some kind of violence. The Roman Republic expanded because of their use of salt, right? And so they were taking over land that had lots of salt, and they used it to trade because that's how they got a lot of their wealth and power. And if you got in the way, guess what they did back then? They killed you. There is not a single hand that is not bloodied when we're talking about going after pretty much every spice out there, okay? Every ingredient that you enjoy has some sort of tie specifically to violence. Do we really need to go back and do this sort of nonsense every year? I get that the Washington Post doesn't like that people like pumpkin spice lattes. And part of the reason, I think, is because they see it as this sort of like privileged drink. Because who's generally drinking the pumpkin spice lattes, right? It's in their world, the 37 to 49-year-old white lady who is privileged, and she likes the pumpkin spice latte. So we got to bring them down a little bit and point out Starbucks is evil. They're still benefiting, even in 2019, from genocide. It's kind of stupid. It's kind of ridiculous. And this, what the Washington Post has become, it's just laughable, and it's almost a parody of itself now. You know why there's so many people who are upset now at the Babylon Bee, which is basically the right-wing version of The Onion? It's because their parodies are sounding so much like a lot of the crap you'll find in Salon and Slate and The Atlantic. And so they're pushing back. Now, at the same time, just because we're talking about food, and now I kind of want a pumpkin spice latte, because they are really good. I know that they're a pain in the ass to make. That's not my fault. Don't blame me. I didn't do it.
I don't like them. I don't drink them.
Okay, well, but people do like them, and they taste good.
But you shouldn't.
I don't, but not because of the genocidal stuff. It's just because there's just empty calories. Let's talk a little bit about food, just because Bernie Sanders was out there today. He was doing an event, and they were talking about climate change. And I would say a quick way to sort of lose the hearts and minds of reasonable people who are saying, you know what, I don't want to do the crazy on the environmentalist stuff, but I do care about the environment. I care deeply about the environment. I want to clean up our land, and I want to make sure that we're here for our grandkids to enjoy, blah, blah, blah. To push them away is to adopt crazy policies. And it feels like, at least in this regard, we're hearing more and more from the voices of the crazy rather than the voices of the reasonable. Now, Bernie Sanders kind of knows that. He knows he can't go too crazy. And if he is going to go crazy, he'll put it in a policy paper that no one's going to read. He's not going to give a soundbite to Fox News to exploit. And so today he was asked a question by someone in the audience saying, hey, do you support a meat tax? like they have in Germany, because the fact of the matter is the more people eat meat, the worse it is for the environment. Listen to his answer. It's kind of talks around the question, but he leaves it open to interpretation.
If we believe, as I do and you do, that climate change is real, we're going to have to tackle it in every single area, including agriculture. Okay, and in fact, one of the things we want to do with our farmers out there is help them become more aggressive and able to help us combat climate change rather than contribute to it. So we will certainly, you're right, we've got to look at agriculture, we've got to look at every cause of the crisis that we face.
Okay, so what does that mean? We've got to look at it, or do you endorse it? Because it sounded like he was answering in the affirmative without actually answering in the affirmative. The whole idea of a meat tax, and he's got to deeply know this, which is probably why he didn't come out right there and say yes, is because that's not going to fly here. That's not going to fly here. We are not going to have a meat tax here. They know that. That's why he talks about it the way he does. And then you've got AOC out there. She's doing the crazy as well. She's saying we shouldn't fly, which, of course, if we ended up going after the transportation industry the way that she wants, we would cripple the economy. And then, of course, what happened this week? Greta Thunberg, she's the 16-year-old climate change activist. She arrived in New York after sailing across the Atlantic on a yacht with solar panels and wind turbines. CBS News reported apparently that the yacht had no kitchen, it had no heater, it had no fridge, it had no bathroom. But she took the yacht because she wanted to raise awareness about the harmful emissions caused by taking commercial airlines. There's no doubt that when you get onto a plane, you are emitting harmful crap into the environment. We know that. We know that. But we're not going to end our dependence on airplanes. What we can do, rather than go into taking a boat across the Atlantic, what we can do is double down on the sort of technological advances to maybe make them more efficient, right? I mean, look at just where the plane is now, or look at where cars are now. Do you think they're just as bad for the environment as they were at the beginning of the advent of the car or the advent of the plane? Of course not. Every single decade that goes by, and really we're at the point where every single year that goes by, we have more technological advancements that make things more efficient. Washington State, great example of this. What are we having a conversation about right now? We have a gas tax that ends up going into funding transportation projects. There is concern that we're going to long-term run out of money because people are not buying gas as much. Why aren't they buying gas as much? Because cars are more fuel efficient, right? And so now we're looking at these different models of pay as you go, pay by the mile, more tolls. Whether we're talking about express toll lanes or congestion pricing in downtown Seattle, they're doing that because less people are buying gas because their cars are more efficient. We just need to double down on that. Maybe offer more perks to businesses to invest in that kind of technology instead of constantly demonizing these companies and say, oh, we're going to tax you for all the carbon. How about you make it so it's easier for them to get to the technology that will actually help save the environment? And this is not like a crazy conservative idea. I feel like this is a reasonable idea, and it's mostly one that I heard Neil deGrasse Tyson talk about not too long ago. He's basically making the exact same point, which is, you know what? At some point, technology is going to help on all of this, so maybe we should make that a little bit easier.
I like that guy. He's fun to watch.
No, he's weird. He's boring. I like Bill Nye, but I don't like Bill Nye.
He's modern-day Bill Nye.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I'll be quiet.
Get Bill Nye's personality and put him in the personality of Neil deGrasse Tyson. You are listening to The Jason Rand Show.